The next case on calendar this morning is Thomas v. Nevada Yellow Cab Corporation, case number 61681. Mr. Greenberg, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
I would ask the court to reserve 4 minutes of my time.
Okay, very well.
May it please the court, I am Leon Greenberg, and I'm arguing today on behalf of the appellants. Nevada's Constitution, Article 15, Section 16, Subsection A, states, and I quote, "Each employer shall pay a wage to each employee of not less than the hourly rates set forth in this section," end quote. That language commands the payment of a wage as specified in that part of Nevada's Constitution, not a wage specified anywhere else in Nevada's revised statutes. As a result, the only question posed by the language I just quoted to the court is, who is an employee within the meaning of subsection A? And subsection C of that same constitutional provision answers that question for us. And it states, an employee for the purposes of subsection A means any person who is employed by an employer. But the term does not include persons who are under 18 years of age, who are employed by certain nonprofits, or who are trainees. The appellants in this case are not under 18 years of age, they are not employed by a nonprofit, and they are not trainees. As a result, the appellants, who are taxi drivers, are clearly and unambiguously within the Nevada Constitution's definition of employee. And as a result,
they are clearly and unambiguously within the definitions indicated in 608250 subsection 2.
That is correct, Your Honor. But what I would point out in respect to that, Your Honor, is 608.250 subsection 2 specifically limits its application to the provisions of 608.250 subsection 1. The very first sentence of subsection 2 states that the provisions of subsection 1 shall not apply. And then it enumerates various groups of employees who are not subject to subsection 1, among them taxi drivers. So by its very language, subsection 2 cannot influence, modify, or otherwise affect any requirements of Nevada law that are not contained in subsection 1. It is simply contrary to the clear express language of subsection 2. And this is a fundamental flaw in the district court's ruling, as well as in the respondent's argument here, Your Honor, in that how does this language of subsection 2 get expanded and applied beyond its express limitation? It cannot, Your Honor. I've never heard of an explanation for why or how that can be done. There's certainly no precedent to do that.
But also, isn't the Constitution paramount? I mean, if it means only what the legislature says it means, where are we?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. And that goes to the fundamental issue that's presented by this dispute, Your Honor, which is one of constitutional supremacy. Assuming that 208.250 sub 2 actually had a broader application, which it does not by its language, as I've pointed out, it could still not displace the command of Nevada's Constitution unless the Constitution itself authorizes the legislature to do so. And there is no authorization granted to the legislature in Nevada's Constitution to modify the requirements of Article 15, Section 16 of Nevada's Constitution. So we are presented with a situation where we have clear and unambiguous language that says these are the minimum wage requirements in Nevada's Constitution, and they must be interpreted and applied pursuant to what is stated in this Constitution and nowhere else. So this court must look to the constitutional language and nowhere else to determine the scope of the application of the constitutional provision. Now, respondents would have this court engage in an examination of the intent behind the enactment of the minimum wage amendment. And this was really the foundation of the district court's decision as well. The problem with that is that there is no ambiguity here. The constitutional language is clear. What can be ambiguous about
each employee must be paid by each employer. There is nothing ambiguous about that as provided for in this section. Again, referencing that section of the Constitution for any questions about the application, the scope of the command that the Constitution is giving us. And as I pointed out in subsection C, it answers that question for us. It tells us who are employees within the meaning of the Constitution. I have never heard respondents offer any explanations to why there is any ambiguity here in the language of the Constitution. I mean, the district court didn't in this case. Judge Jones of the U.S. District Court in the Lucas v. Bell case never identified any ambiguity in the Constitution's language that would justify this intent analysis being conducted. Now, this court has repeatedly ruled that it is without the authority to engage in an examination of the intent behind a constitutional provision when the language is clear and unambiguous. The Nevada mining case went so far as to state we cannot apply such language to mean anything other than what it says. And this is a case where, again, clearly the language of the Nevada Constitution must be applied as it says. There is no dispute as to the language. Now, the intent argument that is made by respondents also is illogical in that it relies upon assumptions that are not supported or really explained. I mean, they make this assumption that the ballot question for the constitutional amendment, which stated, shall the Nevada Constitution be amended to raise the minimum wage paid to employees, that is the literal language, communicated to Nevada's voters that the only purpose of the amendment was to raise the minimum wage for those subject or ready to the provisions of 608.250 subsection 1. The question doesn't make any reference to that. It doesn't state anything of the sort. And in fact, the language of the amendment and the effect of the amendment was precisely in line with what the question directed, which was to raise the minimum wage for Nevada employees, including employees such as taxi drivers who are subject to the minimum wage provisions of federal law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, but who are not or were not, prior to the amendment's enactment, subject to any minimum wage standards under Nevada's statutes. In sum, what happened here is the district court has ignored the fundamental principles of constitutional supremacy upon which our legal system is based. If the rule of law means anything, it means no statute can contradict or limit the clear and unambiguous commands of a constitutional provision. This court and the district court's authority comes from Nevada's constitution, and the citizens of the state of Nevada have expressed their will on what minimum wage shall be paid to Nevada's employees by placing those requirements in Nevada's constitution. As I stated, those requirements are clear and unambiguous, and as a result, the issue presented by this appeal is not, as respondents would argue or have argued, or as the district court found, whether Nevada's voters understood the impact of the amendment when it was enacted overwhelmingly at the polls, or whether they made a wise choice in enacting this provision of the Constitution. The issue presented is one of constitutional supremacy, which goes to the very foundation.
The argument really isn't that it was entirely repealed by the constitutional amendment, 608. So you're not, that's not part and parcel of your argument.
I would submit to put this in an implied repeal context is really using the wrong nomenclature, because what we have here is simply a supersession. We have a constitutional command that simply displaces any more limited or contrary requirements of statute.
But so it doesn't specifically say that. It's trying to put your argument in context.
Well, it needn't say that. I mean, if one were to adopt an implied repeal, a label, an analysis for the issue before the court, which was addressed in the Attorney General's opinion, that was the nomenclature they used, you would reach the same conclusion that I have been explaining to the court, which is that we have constitutional language that is supreme, that controls any contrary or more limited statutory command. Therefore, the constitutional provision must be enforced by this court. If we want to say that's an implied repeal, we can say it's an implied repeal. I mean, the fact remains that 608.250 is not without any residual effect. It still retains some residual importance in the law of Nevada. For example, as I explained, the Constitution exempts certain people under the age of 18 who work for nonprofits. Those individuals are not exempt from the provisions of 608.250. So what we really have here is a legislative framework for minimum wages, which provides for certain exemptions within its own terms, and we have a constitutional framework for minimum wage requirements, which relies on its own terms and exemptions and so forth. So we really have two spheres of legal regulation here, coming from the legislature and from the Constitution itself. As I was saying, it's not for this court to determine whether it was wise for Nevada's voters to enact this provision. And this court obviously doesn't have the power to override the clear and unambiguous commands of Nevada's Constitution. As Chief Justice Marshall noted over 210 years ago in Marbury v. Madison, the government of the United States has been emphatically termed a government of laws and not of men. It will certainly cease to deserve this high appellation if the laws furnish no remedy for the violation of a vested legal right. The appellants in this case have a vested legal right. It is in Nevada's Constitution. This court is duty-bound as the highest law enforcement tribunal in the state to enforce that right and reverse the district.
Counsel, can you address just briefly, if you will, and just get your thoughts. Opposing counsel cited the Lucas case and the Green case on the federal district court supporting your position. The position taken in those cases is the opposite of what you're arguing here today. Would you like to address that at all?
Well, Your Honor, this is actually addressed in my reply submission to the court. And in the Green case, Judge Jones actually goes so far as to state the rules. This is at page 7 of my reply. He states, when the language of a constitutional provision adopted through the initiative process is clear on its face, Nevada courts will not go beyond that language in determining the voter's intent. That is the rule. That's from Miller v. Burke. So Judge Jones recognizes the legal principle that's controlling, but he never explains in Green what ambiguous language or how the constitutional provision is not clear on its face. No one has. And I would challenge respondents to do so today if they wish. I would reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Mr. Greenberg, may it please the court. My name is Tamer Botros, and I represent Nevada Yellow Cab Corporation, Nevada Checker Cab Corporation, and Nevada Star Cab Corporation in this matter, also known as Yellow Checker Star. With me today is my co-counsel, the general counsel of Yellow Checker Star, and my mentor, Mark Gordon. This is my first time for this honorable court, so it is definitely an honor to be here. Yellow Checker Star is a company that has been in business in Las Vegas for 30 years. It employs 2,000 drivers and is a family-owned business. It is fully compliant with state and the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act. Before today, four judges, Judge Douglas Herndon, Judge Kerry Early, Judge Ronald Israel, and a federal district court judge, Judge Robert Jones, ruled and all agreed that there was no implied repeal of NLS 608.250 by adoption of the minimum wage amendment in 2006.
But is that the right question to ask? We have constitutional language that speaks in absolute terms. Every employer and every employee. The Constitution you read first. I'm struggling to find the ambiguity in the constitutional provision that would license us to look to other indicia of intent. Could you tell me why that language is ambiguous?
Absolutely, Chief Justice Pickering. The language is ambiguous because it never referenced NLS 608.250, which is existing law had it actually mentioned in passing that it was basically taking away all of 608.250 and its exceptions, then absolutely it would stand on that. But the fact that it remained silent, and also the four judges recognized the main focus of the constitutional amendment was the minimum breach amount.
But they're getting that out of extraneous materials. Looking at it as a closed universe of text, there's nothing to suggest that its purpose was so limited, is there?
Well, if you read Article 15, Section 16, Subsection C, the definition of an employee. Employee means any person who's employed by an employer is defined, but does not include an employee who's under age of 18, employed by a nonprofit organization for after school or summer employment. That's referring to high school students. That's referring to teenagers. That is included and can happily coexist with NRS 608.250 and its exceptions, which includes casual babysitters, employees who work on based off commission, taxi cab and limousine drivers, as well as agriculture workers.
But wouldn't the argument be that the constitutional provision sees fit to exempt casual babysitters, nonprofit employees, and whatever the third category is, and that by excluding specific categories and omitting to mention any others, that it does cover them?
That's the dilemma, Chief Justice Pickering. It never references specifically. And for a constitutional amendment to stand on source without mentioning the existing law, which has not been void or unconstitutional by this honorable court, that's the major ambiguous point. Right now, NRS 608.25 and all of its exceptions stand in the books. They have not been ruled unconstitutional or void.
As a statute, but not as a constitutional amendment, the implied repeal rule generally involves statutory conflicts, statutes enacted subsequent to earlier statutes that don't reference the prior statute. Here we have a constitutional amendment. Why shouldn't the rule be examined differently in that context?
Because in none of the explanation or argument sections of that constitutional amendment, Justice Hardesty, it never referenced NRS 608.250. It's as if it didn't exist. Had it mentioned that, at least in passing, then absolutely, that would be paramount. But the fact that it was omitted, which means...
Really, you're making this argument on the basis of the implied repeal rule, a rule that generally addresses questions where subsequent statutory enactments are in conflict or apparent conflict with prior statutory enactments. This is a constitutional amendment. It is the supreme law of the state. Why wouldn't we take a different view? And there does seem to me to be a conflict between the language in the constitutional amendment and the provisions that exist in the statute. Inherent, it says that people under 18 are exempted. Taxi cab drivers are over 18. Isn't there an inherent conflict in those two exemptions?
I would submit to you, just hard to see that they can coexist.
How? I read with interest the comments made by Judge Jones in Lucas. And the only basis, after reciting the rule that says implied repeal of a statute is heavily disfavored, again citing statutory conflicts, not a constitutional conflict. I'm not sure that the heavily disfavored language applies where the citizens of this state vote an amendment to the Constitution that changes the whole configuration of wage law.
Well, Justice Hardesty, in Board of Retirement versus Superior Court, a case that has been cited by appellants as well as respondents in our brief, that same issue came up. There was a law, in fact, in 1937, about basically not having disability retirement funds of county employees, in that particular case in Los Angeles, not be in any way garnished for any civil process, with certain exceptions. In 1982 in California, they passed Proposition 8, constitutional amendment, as you just mentioned, Justice Hardesty. And the trial court in that particular case, ruled that individual is subject to the Constitutional Amendment, Proposition 8, and basically ordered the Los Angeles County Retirement Fund to garnish wages because this person had basically was involved in a misdemeanor violation, and the other side was seeking restitution. This came up on appeal, Justice Hardesty, and here's what the court ruled. Both of those, the Constitutional Amendment, mm-hmm. as well as the statute, can cohabitably exist. Because at the end of the day, the person who is suffering from loss of personal property or vandalism can go after the person who caused it. They don't need to go through the Los Angeles County Retirement because that was a state-established law. And the proposition of the victim's right back in California, that proposition, which passed, and the Constitutional Amendment, can coexist with that law. Same analysis applies here, Justice Hardesty. The exceptions in 608.250 can cohabitably exist with respect to the Constitutional Amendment that was passed.
Mr. Beecher, so we had, isn't there a case, I don't know if either one of you have thought about this case. We had a case in 2008 called In re Chutin. Judge Robert Chutin was appointed to the district court, and the question was for what length of time he could be appointed, and the majority of the court concluded that the appointment by the governor for the period was illegal because even though the statute authorized it, it violated the Constitution on the term of office of the judges. Have you come across that case? And I know if you're not familiar, it's nothing to do with labor law or anything, but it does deal with the issue of statutes in direct conflict with the Constitution, and the court did say the Constitution trumped it in that particular case.
Mm-hmm. I have not, Justice Gibbons. I profusely apologize for that. Mm-hmm. However, I can say that the one case that was cited by appellants that they rely on, which is Board of Retirement versus Superior Court, a California case, mm-hmm. references what was going on in this particular case about a constitutional amendment that was passed and an existing law. Mm-hmm. And they ruled that basically they can cohabitate exist and there was no implied repeal.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm trying to understand the mechanics of cohabitate existing. Kind of cute words, but how does a provision that says that people under 18 don't qualify for this minimum wage coexist with a provision that taxi cab drivers are exempt? If a taxi cab driver is over the age of 18, I struggle to understand how the two provisions coexist.
Justice Hardesty, I made a mistake, and my general counsel boss is going to mention about it actually means...
You should applaud your performance. You're doing great. Don't worry about that.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. It's actually the proper term that we use in our brief is happily coexist. Not cohabitate, he says.
Yeah, I was the one that flipped. Apart from this syntax, how do these provisions coexist, whether happily or otherwise?
Because we have NLS 608.250 at the time mm-hmm. the voters went to the polls in 2006 and voted for this. We have to look, Justice Hardesty, to the intent of the voter at the time. Even the Attorney General's opinion said the main focus of this minimum wage amendment is not so much the classifications, absolutely not. The main focus is the minimum wage amount. And what is that? To raise it to $5.15 for employers who were providing health benefits at the time and $6.15 for employers who were not providing health benefits. So you're trying to link them together. Certainly, as Arbus mentioned, Justice Hardesty, Constitutional Amendment made no reference of any of those exceptions. It references, I understand, with respect to the 18 years of age and so forth. You can take that, Justice Hardesty, and put it as one of the other exceptions, because that specifically deals with teenagers and high school individuals of that age, and they can happily coexist. We would have a different situation had the clear wording of the explanation or argument included NUS 608.250 and its exceptions no longer apply. But right now, as it stands, that is the law.
What do we offer this hypothetical?
setting aside the existing constitutional provision in Nevada's constitution that limits marriage between a husband or between a male and a female. Suppose that didn't exist, and the legislature adopts a statute that says marriage can exist between gay persons or lesbian persons. And the Nevada Constitution is then amended by the people, consistent with the current amendment, which limits marriage to a male and a female, without referencing the existing statute. Has there been an implied repeal? Or can they happily exist?
I would submit to you, Justice Hardesty, that is an entirely different case than we have here. And the reason being is because that refers to familial relationships. Here we're talking strictly about labor and employment and minimum wage. The hypothetical that you just suggested, Justice Hardesty, would obviously be in conflict. But that's not what we have here. Because what we have here is NRS 608.250's exceptions, which has existed for quite some time. The hypothetical that you suggested, Justice Hardesty, actually is short in duration in time between the statute that has passed and the week thereafter the constitutional amendment. This statute, NRS 608.250, has been on the books for a very long time in the great state of Nevada. So, to answer your question, in that hypothetical, there would be in conflict. But in this case, not in conflict.
Can you address, and maybe I misunderstood the argument, opposing counsel's argument. He was indicating that 608.250E only applies to subsection 1 of the statute.
Justice Perry, go ahead.
Therefore, there's no conflict, there's no...
608, the entire 608, it is a long section deals with the Labor Commission without a wage law in Nevada. If we basically take the approach that accounts have argued today, Justice Baird, Gary, it eliminates 608 entirely. Because they argue that the constitutional amendment was an entire revision of all of Nevada law regarding minimum wage. Certainly, the constitutional amendment didn't mention that. It mentioned each employee shall be paid from an employer minimum wage, and it sets that amount. It never gets to the question about exceptions, exemptions, or any of those occupational exemptions that you just mentioned. 608.250, subsection E, all its provisions remain on the books. And we believe that it was the drafters of the constitutional amendment, they likely were aware of NRS 608.250 and intended that it would happily coexist. Because had they not intended that, they would have certainly put it in there that it's stated that NRS 608.250 and all its provisions shall no longer apply. That would have been a powerful statement, and obviously it would have been constitutional supremacy, but that was left out. That was not even mentioned. It was as if NRS 608.250 never existed. I hope I answered your question, Justice Berger.
Thank you.
And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. Mr. Greenberg, you have 2 minutes and 47 seconds.
Yeah, Mr. Greenberg, I had one question I could ask after hearing opposing counsel's argument here. Do you feel, although you're representing taxi and limousine drivers here, what about casual babysitters, domestic service employees, and outside salespersons? Do you feel that they are entitled to minimum wage as well based upon the constitutional amendment?
Well, the language of the constitutional amendment is clear, and in respect to your question involving different groups of workers, there is the language regarding persons who are under 18 years working. I think it says nonprofit organizations. So it would be a question as to what the interpretation of that would be. But a 16-year-old babysitter working for...
Well, let's say they're almost a 19-year-old babysitter. Are they now subject to minimum wage?
I would have to say yes, Your Honor. I mean, the language of the Constitution does control here, and this, of course, was what I had explained to the court previously. It's not a question of the wisdom of this amendment. We've had constitutional amendments in this country. I think we all know about prohibition, for example, that proved not to be very good social or public policy. But whether that is or is not a good statutory constitutional framework, excuse my language, that's beyond the power of this court to determine. That is, of course, to the people. In respect to respondents' argument regarding the border retirement case, this is discussed at pages 12 and 13 of my reply. I do believe respondent has not clearly presented the issue that was resolved in border retirement. What border retirement did is it resolved conflicts between statutes that themselves were implementing statutes of two contrary constitutional directives. One was a constitutional directive preserving certain pension rights of public employees. The other was a constitutional directive that was giving crime victims a remedy. Statutes were enacted to enforce those provisions. That was where the conflict arose. Here you have a constitutional provision that speaks to the subject matter, minimum wage, but it doesn't give the legislature any authority to modify its terms, and respondents have not pointed to any other constitutional provision that would somehow support a conflict that's before the court regarding 608.250. As I have previously explained, there is no coexistence question here because the language of 608.250, subpart 2, is simply a limitation on the reach of subpart 1. So therefore, it's not even a question of a conflict. It's a question of what the language of that statute provides and what the language of Nevada's Constitution provides. We have this assumption by the respondents and by Judge Jones that somehow 608.250 subpart 2 is intended to modify every provision of minimum wage law in the state of Nevada. It clearly doesn't from its express language. I've never heard of an explanation as to how it can. So I think the court well understands the constitutional supremacy issue here that is at the heart of the party's dispute. I am out of time unless there are questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel, for your briefs and all arguments. They were excellent. And the matter will stand submitted and will be in recess.